With Gordon Stanley on 12th August 1981. You were saying Ted McCarthy and Don Urquhart. Could you spell Don's last name?
U-R-Q-U-A-R-T.
And what about them?
They went to the National, it's called the National Geophysical Institute or something like that. It was a branch of the government anyhow that was surveying for oil in Western Australia and other places. Don, I saw him again some years after that. He had a bad case of poliomyelitis. I believe that he was crippled for, I don't know, for life, for a long time.
But they never published anything, right?
They never published anything.
What did they do?
Well, they helped with the observation and the setting up of things. Radiophysics was a highly structured organization, although it wasn't, in some ways, as I said, it was very loose, too.
Yeah.
But they definitely, I can't remember specifically what their duties were, but they definitely helped quite a lot with the early observations. Mm-hmm. And the other guy I'm mentioning, the guy I worked with at North Head and also on CWL, I wish I could remember his name. I remember something about him. Alex Shane was a beautiful guy, and this guy as well was in some ways like Alec. He used to go down to the beaches on Sundays and conduct prayer meetings, but that's as much as I can remember, except that he taught at the Tech for a little while after that.
But what did this fellow do? He was the same kind. He never published anything, but he was...
never published anything. The observations I was doing at North Head were, I started to move. It's funny, it's hard to recall. There were so many observations I did on the sun in those days. As I said, there were the polarization measurements of the Great Easter Sunspot. I think it was in 1946. When was the Great Easter Sunspot? You can remember that.
I've never heard that term before.
Well, we called it the Great Easter Sunspot in Australia.
February 46 was the huge area that was in the McCready, Fawzi and Payne Scott paper.
This was after that. It must have been in 47.
Maybe either 46 or 47, I guess.
So as I say, my chronology is sloppy. And then I will not go further into... we wanted to cover the business of the sources anyhow before I cut off this business of history. The first four sources, I think, are...
Oh, yeah, right. We're coming
and
to that.
And we can talk on...
But let me just say that I was mixing up the names of Arthur Higgs and Harley Wood.
Yeah.
Higgs I did interview.
Yeah,
but Hollywood I did not.
Yeah,
so I did get things.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back then to, you say you had these fringes with difficulty on Cygnus A.
Yeah.
John Bolton was called in to join you.
Yeah.
And then what was your operational procedure? I mean, how did you go about trying to see whether there were other sources or?
Well, John and I worked very well together. We were good friends, and it was a good. We supplemented each other very well with John's background and mine. So what we did, I mean, in those days, I can remember operating as much as 3 days almost straight without any rest at all, just observing to see what we could see. I mean, we just covered the sky as well as
moving
well
as in azimuth to different positions and just letting the sky.
Yes, to some extent it was random because, of course, we didn't have the time. We could get those later papers, which you had listed there, where we had 104 sources and things like that. Took time to come back. But I think it's a bit like discovering oil. You hit the big ones first. In retrospect, I think it's very easy to see how we saw NGC 5128 and Taurus, both quite large and both quite strong.
Mm-hmm.
And of course Cygnus had already been discovered. But there was sort of competition between us, I suppose, like that. I mean, we'd go out and say, well, I think I got the first one, but I really can't swear to that, and I think it was Taurus. And then John sort of tried to play it down and say, well, okay. And I think John saw Virgo first, because it was mighty weak. And for the life of me, I can't remember Centaurus, but we certainly didn't look in the star catalog or anything like that. We just
to look in likely positions, you mean?
And we picked up the four. We picked up the four. You were probably most likely. They were the four strongest ones.
So you never, think, when you say you didn't look in the star catalog, you didn't look in there and say, Crab Nebula, let's look extra hard.
No.
As the position of the Crab
Nebula.
No,
it came as a shock, actually, the identification, which really... We didn't think in terms of identifying.
Right.
Didn't think what they were. I suppose the most remarkable thing, NGC 5128 was a real surprise. Of course, that was the first big breakthrough. We had extragalactic sources, something very odd was going on.
Although, in that first paper, there was an indication that there was even some controversy amongst optical astronomers as to whether this thing was extragalactic.
Oh, yeah. Sure there was. I mean, nobody...
But Virgo, there's no doubt about that.
There was great doubt about Virgo. There was a lot more doubt about Virgo, because Virgo... Centaurus is an obvious galaxy, and it's obviously a large galaxy. But Virgo, I mean, I think that was the more remarkable thing, and John should take full credit for that. I mean, it was his work that did the identification on that. It's nothing particularly remarkable about it, except that it's got a jet on it. And the jet was one of those things, as I found when I got to Pasadena, that astronomers were not that head up about.
It was
just sort of a peculiar galaxy, and they really didn't... I don't think the jet was really... noticed very much.
No,
just
by chance there happened to be this short exposure photograph from 1918 or something, but no one had ever remarked on it ever since. But I think you misunderstood me. I wasn't saying that these identifications were...
You're saying that
the extragalactic nature, I mean, Centaurus was argued about, but Virgo you couldn't argue about it. I mean, everyone agreed it was an elliptical galaxy in the Virgo cluster, I think.
I don't think... I never heard that argument that Centaurus or NGC 5128 was not extragalactic. I can't say no. Looking at the photographs, I find it rather hard. I don't know who came up with
it.
There it is. It's a very normal-looking galaxy with a dark obscuring band across the center.
Yeah, but that's a very abnormal obscuring band.
Right.
I think probably... But in your original Nature paper, sorry I don't have it here, there is this reference that it's just not clear if it's extragalactic, and you cite someone who thought it would maybe be a weird planetary nebula.
I think you better put that remark down. I don't recall it.
But you don't recall any doubt.
I don't recall. Well, sure, I had a doubt myself. Let me put that in perspective. I had a doubt that any of them were extragalactic. Quite frankly, I didn't really believe John's identification. I believed Taras later. But I really, I mean, here were two out of the blue. What reason did we have? Synchrotron radiation had not been accepted at that time. We had the old problem with free emission. I mean, how far can you see? These numbers had been brought up before. Even Jansky was not really believed. I mean,
you need
somebody to think up simple thermal processes to explain Jansky's result. So you take another step forward. This is the disbelief amongst people like Woolley when they said they don't exist.
Yeah.
Or D.F. Martin, who said they're comets on hyperbolic orbits.
Yeah. I mean, were you bothered by the fact, for instance, that the Magellanic Clouds weren't giving you a strong source? I mean, why should these nebulae, which are so much further away, do it, and nothing in the Magellanic Clouds or nothing in other large near galaxies?
I didn't think... I think the answer to that is we just didn't know enough astronomy to get that esoteric about things.
Yeah.
But my own... I'm giving you my own personal view.
Oh, that's what I want.
My own personal view is that I was only 50% convinced that indeed the... I mean, here we had... we had two identifications, and then there was a later paper, as you saw, with Kevin Westphal. That was partly an argument between me and John, because they said they don't believe most of the... Indeed, most of the identifications in that were wrong.
In the paper with Westphal?
I didn't use the Magellan Clouds, but I used Cygnus. I mean, here is the strongest source in the sky, and we can't see any darn thing there at all. I mean, we've got there's a field published in that paper in an Australian Physical Journal. There's an airplane track going across it.
Right.
I was up there the night that was taken. That was the night I went to the candlelight dinner at D.F. Martin's.
When that photograph was taken, I think that's actually the first overlay that ever was published in Radio Astronomy.
Right.
You have this plastic sheet.
But it was only to protect the photo. There's nothing on the other side. This is a position on this, isn't there?
Well, there's as I remember, there's a wax paper type sheet that goes over it with a little box on it or something.
Oh, yeah, there's a box on it. Right. Well, I said there's nothing on that. I didn't have to be as esoteric as the Magellan Clouds. And I said, here we are, we have so many other sources, and you've got... I said I'd probably believe NGC 5128, but I said Virgo's really stretching it.
Right. Who took that photograph? I can't remember.
Gottlieb. He was a little Austrian guy.
Right. But now let's go back to these identifications.
Fear and trembling of D.F. Martin. I remember that.
These identifications. How did it come up? I mean, the idea to try identifications, and then how did the specific identifications, how were they made, as you recall it?
Okay. The way it was done, in effect, was that to try identification was obvious. Of course, okay, we've got something which is extremely small. It can be either stellar or it can be extragalactic. The most likely explanation is, although even the theory can't even support this, is that it's stellar. I mean, there was a big argument. This argument went on for years, even after I got onto Pasadena. I mean, everybody had their pet idea of what the radio sources were, red giants, you name it. Magnetic stars had kicked around until the 60s, I think, and things like that, until I think it was Bartabet Minkowski, A Case of Scotch,
yeah.
Discovered the first radio star.
And colliding galaxies became the thing.
I think they were both dead before first radio star turned up. Well, the colliding galaxies brought us into the extragalactic argument, but most of the arguments were for stellar type objects.
Right. So but let's go back now to 1948-49. Let's not get too much ahead. I'm asking you then about...
Well, that came up immediately. The business on odd objects, I mean, nobody knew anything much about astronomy. So everybody went to their astronomy book. Gamma was the most popular, The Birth and Death of the Sun, when we started on that.
Yeah.
And Gamma, of course, talked a little bit about cosmology as well. And he talked about types of stars, and we were biased by working on the sun, so I guess most of the arguments were for stellar type objects.
Mm-hmm.
So, however, as I said, it was a small object, and the chances were there was an odd chance that it could indeed be extragalactic. And I feel that this is why I said to John the other day that somewhat a personal experience I can't put in words, a sort of exhilaration you felt about things at that time. It didn't really seem to be very important what the rest of the world thought about it. You knew what had happened yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes, it's not a resentment really, but I don't really care that much, but you sometimes feel that people really didn't realize, or people really haven't really woken up to what happened then, or what happened in those 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't
woken
up. What the impact uh-huh. of the things were. There's a line in Slosky's book, which I can't remember. I think Slosky is a very sensitive man who put it rather well. I can't remember it, but if I can, I'll dig it out and look at it.
Yeah.
But we had no reason. The synchrotron radiation, as I said, was not accepted at that time. Nobody had we had to grasp for what we thought was the most likely. And the preponderance of opinion was that if they were real, it had to be stellar. And then we'd think about the mechanism, and the theoreticians could fight over the mechanism for the next 10 years.
What did you actually look at in fact to find out these tentative identifications anyway?
Well, some of them we took photographs on. People at Stromlo collaborated. I don't think they'd be fully acknowledged on how that was done. NGC 5128 was easy. Mostly we looked up star catalogs. We'd learned about precession by then, so we had a precession for the right date.
Right.
So mostly we just looked up star catalogs. And then with these, I think, Rudolf Minkowski in particular at Caltech was becoming interested. And Rudolf, of course, when it came to the crab, we did the crab without him, but of course after that he was deeply interested.
Yes, because he had worked on it.
Right.
Long before, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
And really we had, I think the crab, we didn't realize it at the time, but the crab provided us with the essential clue, because it was the first supernova in the be identified,
mm-hmm.
and we'd have had enough mass for if the synchrotron mechanism had existed, or the knowledge of the synchrotron mechanism had existed, then I think we would have been able to fit the pieces together.
Well, that's easy to say in retrospect.
Sure, I thought, I can tell you what I thought about the theory when it first came out. I thought, gee, this is a very convenient mechanism, it can explain anything.
Yeah, well, in fact, it does turn out that it seems to, or at least that's the best we've been able to come up with even to date.
Yeah.
Okay, so you had these first few identifications, and But you were doing other work besides just identifications. I mean, for instance, in 1950, you published on spectra of the sources. Now, did this involve completely different aerials?
No. Well, I built the, by that time, the first work was done with single Yagis mounted on an old sort of rotating tables that we used to look at, take antenna patterns with.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I decided was that we had this old mattress array, which was at 200 megahertz, and we didn't particularly want to work at 200 megahertz, although I did use it for a little while. So we both had somewhat of a cavalier attitude, although John was somewhat braver than I was on things. He said, let's cut it down one day. And it was a huge thing. It was about 16 by 18 and built like a battleship. So we cut the thing down. We got a guy out, cut it down, cut it into pieces, and left it by the side of the cliff. And then a little while later, John says, well, it doesn't look too tidy. Let's get rid of it. So we pushed it over the cliff. We had some irate fishermen come up and see us some months after. What's going on up there? We just got missed by. Anyhow, I redesigned the backup structure and built this 9 Yagi array at 75 megahertz, mm-hmm. which was used in all those subsequent papers when the 104 sources were detected.
Right.
So we did all the obvious things. I mean, okay, you've got something, you've got to find out a mechanism. So what do you do first? You do the spectra.
And what did you
look
make
for
of
more
it?
Sources? What did you make of it?
What did you make of it when you had the spectra now?
Well, we were tricked by the crab.
Yeah.
We got it's the we I think the now I can't my chronology goes haywire again because it wasn't too long after the spectra were published before synchrotron radiation started to come to the fore, and at least in the cases outside the crab it was said that it was consistent with synchrotron radiation.
Yeah,
but I didn't have any great faith in the explanation, I remember that, but exactly what the chronology was, whether it was 2 years or 6 months after that, it didn't seem a very long time.
But the crab spectrum, of course, was much flatter.
Yes.
And
it's the only one which remains. It's those four spectra or so which were published. It's the only one which I have any degree of pride in now.
Why is that?
It reasonably accurately foretold the state. It said something unusual about one particular object, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the others, sure, it was necessary to publish spectra at that time, so they're not completely crazy. I suppose they're important in that respect.
Yeah.
It was a step you had to go through.
Right. Now, another thing that had to be sorted out, it would seem to me, was the whole business of the fluctuations in the sources.
Yeah, okay.
Can you tell me that right from the beginning? I mean, did you experience them right from the start, or...?
Yes, we did a lot of... We experienced the fluctuations right from the start, and we did... it wasted an awful lot of time, it said to me. We did tie down where they were coming from, and we knew part of the ionosphere and things like that. It was tedious work, and we had the data there. I mean, we worked with the people, there was the era of ionospheric recorders, and there were piles and piles of data, and we found to our disappointment. It was a tedious job because we found here were these girls sitting on these machines looking at little rolls of film for God knows how long, and taken because they'd been told to take off certain types of data, they'd taken it off, and they hadn't taken off the data we wanted.
Right.
And so we had rooms full of photographic film if we wanted to dig back into this data.
And did you? I mean,
we found it was unnecessary, really. Yeah. We got round it, and we, to our own satisfaction, decided where the fluctuations were coming from. Bruce, I was 100% convinced very early that it was a ionosphere. Bruce was not.
Bruce Lee.
Right. And Bruce published an early paper, it's unlucky for him in a way. He published an early paper saying the variations were real, but they can't have been real in this source that he was looking at.
Well, you mean intrinsic to the source?
Intrinsic to the source, because that was even, I mean, there have been so many unbelievable things. I mean, you can't pile too many coincidences one on top of the other. And I mean, the next coincidence to say that sources vary just broke the camel's back as far as I was concerned. And we all knew that the galaxies were 20,000 light years across, or rough about. It's impossible to think of things which are much smaller than that.
So you were definitely thinking of the radiation coming from the entire galaxy. You had no evidence for that, really, but it just made more sense.
Yes, it did. I don't think the real... Just before I came to this country, I was starting to get the feel, which I'm surprised to hear everybody's coming back on this one now, that, you know, because I think it was Bada told me this, when I got to Pasadena, that all galaxies had a core, which you couldn't, a stellar core almost, which you couldn't easily see.
Right.
I think he did actually see it in the case of the Andromeda in those wartime observations of his. That was sort of looked at and sort of forgotten at the time, but I had a feeling. I had my own intuition said there's an order to everything from the supernova remnants out to the galaxies, and that seems to me to be the way that it's worked out. Mm-hmm. The phenomena is something similar between the phenomena that occur in all cases.
You mean an explosion type thing with a central...
with a very small central object.
But you just said, though, that you were using the argument that the galaxies were large things and therefore they couldn't be varying very fast.
I said at the time, I didn't believe the variations until... Well, actually, Alan Moffat, you know, saw about variations before Ken Kellerman, but he didn't have faith enough to publish them either.
But you're talking about
when I'm getting way ahead. The intrinsic variations.
Yeah,
but there was not a dichotomy there. This is a case of the time scale. Again, I said before I came to this country, I was starting to believe.
Oh, I see.
I was starting to believe that you had this situation because I started.
Mid-50s, you're talking about.
Right, yeah. Right, the mid-50s, I was starting to feel a little bit that way. The reason was I started to, I felt that we were over-eager. I felt that there were so many things that happened that we bypassed a lot of the dog work that mm-hmm. had to be done.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that it was not simple to classify the radio sources into the classes we had. I felt that there were intrinsically large diameter sources, weak, like NGC 5128. And I thought we'd find more and more of that sort of structure, and they may indeed be a class of source all by themselves. And then there were what I would have called the normal galaxies. Of course, Hanbury Brown published quite a lot along this line too.
Right.
My thoughts were only philosophical, not hard on that.
Is it fair to say that you may remember in 1950 there were these two papers by Little and Lovell and by Graham Smith with results from Jodl and Cambridge? Is it fair to say that long before they came out, the Australian side was convinced that they were ionospheric, but it's just a matter of you hadn't published it?
Well, everybody in the Australian groups were run in a different way. I have to come back to Joe on that. I said that's my personal opinion. I think the only one in Sydney who thought that there might be a possibility that the variations were intrinsic to the source was Bruce Lee.
Hmm.
I think that's a fair statement.
Right. But then why do you bring up Joe Fawzi's name?
Well, the reason I bring up Joe Fawzi's name was Joe ran the group. You know how Cambridge is run. I mean, I remember you were talking about the Paris meeting. I thought that was fascinating because that was the start of the big frontal confrontation between Bernie and Martin.
Right.
And I was sitting... did you go to Paris, or do you know?
I don't go back quite that far, but...
Well, it was, I've heard many accounts of it. It was summer, it was in a hot... It was in a... You know, sort of almost a dungeon in a basement, and you were sitting there sweltering. And I remember on that day of that discussion, I was sitting directly behind Martin Rowe.
Yes.
And all of the way to the left of Martin were his people, you know,
right.
On the one row. They were all there, see. And he didn't answer Bernie himself. Peter Scheurer was sent up to answer Bernie.
Yes.
Peter stood up there, and every time a point would come up, I would see Martin scribble something, and it would be passed along the row and then out to the front of Peter. Well, it was a very rigid control. It was the whole point with the Cambridge group, and you have to have an exceptional guy like Martin to be able to do that sort of thing. Joe didn't run the group in that way. I mean, sort of, whether by plan or by accident, I really don't know. It just floated, and you could find two people working on exactly the same thing in radio physics. That occurred very frequently, you know,
mm-hmm.
and quite a lot of money being expended in both cases.
Yeah.
It was a very inefficient organization, in that sense. It was inefficient. And maybe it's the right way. I haven't decided to this.
Well, radio physics also had this. Science.
So you get a wider spectrum of opinions.
Right.
I find that any scientific organization, I've noticed this even at Caltech, that there is a tendency to monolithic conformity in certain areas. I sometimes think it delays science a lot. For example, the cosmological question, again, is a case in point. Chip Arp sits there at Caltech still to some extent by himself, although there are doubters.
Well, also in radio physics, you have this situation very different from Cambridge where there were these field sites scattered all over.
Right.
And I'd be interested in your comment on, do you see them as a result of the fact that you had these independently minded people, or was this simply the result of a very loose direction from Pawsey and Bowen, or was this a purposeful plan? I mean,
no, it was very loose direction. It was very loose direction. I don't think Taffy was exactly loose in his direction, but Joe was quite loose. When, you know, I forgot to mention Bernie, of course, was one of the important people at the lab when I came, trying to set the chronology of things. He was there.
But not in radio astronomy.
No, he was not in radio astronomy.
Accelerators or something.
Yes, he was in accelerators, and then he was working when I first came there on video circuits. And then he became very ill. He had tuberculosis, you know, and he was off ill for 18 months. And when he came back, we were well established. I mean, I do think what there was some unhappiness in the lab then because John and I sort of were getting all the kudos and everything was going beautifully for us, and some of the other people were feeling a little bit, you know, when people are not really moving, they start to get a little bit upset. So it was suggested that Bernie actually come out to Dover and work with us, and he made the sort of answer, this is where I think you probably got your impression that everybody says the same as I'm doing, but it's a psychological problem with me. He said no, he said I want to have my own own operation. And that's when Alec came back into radio astronomy. Alec worked for a very short time with Ross Trahan, I forget, a bit of the sun work, and then he went back into whatever he was doing, and then came back again when Bernie came back to the lab and worked with Bernie.
Right. But why was there never set up some kind of a central location and everyone could still have their own field, at least have the fields next to each other?
You'd have to. It's just that it is a very loose it was a very loose organization in those days. I mean, why should they tolerate somebody like me who was in a very junior position, who sort of was tied to nobody and just did more or less what he'd done well pleased? I mean, I sort of look back with it a little bit in horror, because the way I run a group is...
You would never let yourself do that.
I wouldn't let myself do it, no.
Okay, back to...
But it worked. It worked.
The proof is in the pudding. I mean, it came off... very well.
But I'm sure there was no plan.
Yeah. The fluctuations in Cygnus A, therefore, most of you were convinced from early on, but nevertheless, you did a lot of work to establish this.
It took us seemed like a lot of waste time. I felt it was going to come out that way, and I never really felt much doubt it was going to work out that way.
But this was largely Bruce Lee that was wanted to see all of this work be done to establish it.
Well, he'd put so much of his own, he kept it up and he put so much, I often think the mark of a good scientist is that he's not objective, really. He's often very subjective and stubbornly pursues an idea which is past its time and gets something out of it. Mm-hmm. I think Martin Lyle's built that way.
Yeah. Okay, the next publication I come upon is in this series of papers on 104 radio sources. With Westfold has now joined the team, it looks like, also. But now, is this with this same array that you built?
Yes. The reason for Kevin coming into the group is interesting. John ever trusted strictly theoretical people, and he said they all have to do some manual work, some experimental work. Kevin really disliked Joe because of this, and he sort of was told he had to go and do this sort of thing. We had a mathematics group under Tom Piercy, and Kevin was part of that. And Kevin's background, he wrote a book on Laplace transforms. And,
later he worked with Smerd and all of that theoretical
Kevin was added to the group, and it was a very valuable addition at the time.
What was the value?
Well, on our mathematical and theoretical problems, he was very useful.
But what were those problems? In the interpretation of what the sources were?
No. Kevin had no... he used to come to me, even when I was at when he came and taught at Caltech, he would come to me on interpreting. He was a type of mathematician, I'm sure you've seen them, that doesn't have any sort of physical insight. He would ask me crazy questions on the physics of certain mm-hmm. things. But he was on mathematical theory, he was great.
Right. So this was actually in the reduction of the data
right,
that was the primary
right, in the reduction of the data.
Yeah.
Was essentially it. And some of the early confusion problems and things like that. Mm-hmm. He was very, very valuable on that sort of thing. And he was a very disciplined man. I know he was one of the men who said to me that if I didn't practice my mathematics every day, I know that if I left it alone for a week or 2 weeks, it would be very difficult for me to go back to it. Hmm. And that's the type of person he was.
Hmm. There's a question by the side. There's a picture of a dish of about 15 foot diameter.
Oh yeah,
Dover Heights.
I designed it.
Where does that come in?
Okay, it was well. Maybe I'm trying to keep the story continuous so it keeps flowing. I had the feeling, you know, I didn't get the depth of depression John did, but I do get a feeling about things like I had about the Arns Valley and I had it about this. I knew that about 1951 we were past the peak on yes. this instrument and we had to get something else.
Right.
And so I thought, well, the best way out, this is another thing, I just took off, and I have no control over me at all. In effect, I just took off on my own and said, okay, I'm going to design the largest dish that's ever been built. And I talked to Keith McAllister a little bit about it, and Keith gave me some ideas, but essentially what I did, I sat down and drew the thing up myself, the idea being that we could get to shorter wavelengths and that we wouldn't have the restrictions. Why people use paraboloids now.
Yes.
We wouldn't be tied down to the Yagi array was a nice way to get started. But now we were building our own receivers. We weren't relying on old radar receivers and things like that. And there was an obvious need to push our frequencies up as far as we could. Now, I set that up for 200 megahertz. And by the time it got going, really got going, I think, John was starting to have trouble with Joe. Joe was trying to make a decision on where we should be. He was now trying to control things and trying to control all these rebellious people that he had and say, we've got to get a lot more money and we can't go on these 6 months experiments and we've got mm-hmm. to make a decision where our major instrument would be. And he decided for Bernese Cross with Alec.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a little bit of history in that because John and I had concocted a two-element interferometer I decided would be not as the Arns Valley was built, but in barrel type paraboloids.
Cylindrical paraboloids.
Right. We didn't have the financial resources down there that we had in the United States finally, but I thought I could build them cheaply. And we would be able to get that through. But
roughly what size were you thinking of?
About the size we finally built in the Arns Valley, which was 90 feet.
But cylindrical ballots.
Cylindrical.
Only north-south movable.
Right.
Is what you're thinking.
Right, on tracks again.
Oh, on tracks also.
On tracks, yes, on tracks.
I think I do remember.
And this is part of the story of how DAPTA was established. It's an essential part of it.
Oh, okay. How does that tie in?
Well, we're starting to get off. I was saying, let's come back to it in a minute, but I was saying that I had the feeling about this stage when we got to the point of that 104 sources page and the 3 grand papers, you know, and the Swedes were to be the ultimate papers on what the radio sources were, and yet I felt they weren't the ultimate papers. I felt we were showboating a little bit, as a matter of fact, at that stage. I knew something else had to be done on the instrumentation. And so I started the 18-foot parabola, and when John also at that time conceived the idea for the hole in the ground,
mm-hmm.
But the parabola was built first. John was still in radio astronomy at that time. And I did quite a few observations at 200 megahertz, which I don't think I ever published.
Of radio sources?
Of radio yeah. sources. In fact, sorry, it must have been earlier than that. My chronology must be wrong because the spectra paper came out of that darn dish.
Oh, I see.
That's where the spectra came from.
So right. That's before 55.
So it's before, well, at 55 I was here.
You came to the States in 55.
Right, right.
Well, that spectra paper was published in Nature in 56, but it was also Well, I'm not sure if it was mentioned at Jodrell.
Okay, well, that means that the spectra, that's, and the chronology is correct. John, it was on the wind down period, and I did the spectra. I built the dish to do the spectra, and I realized after while I was doing it, and I really couldn't milk much more out of the dish in terms of the receivers that we had available at that time. John, in a last desperate move, sort of did the 90-foot hole in the ground, but at that time he said to me one day, John always was making gestures like this, he said to me one day, he said, I'm going to meet Joe and have a showdown on the business about whether they build the cross or whether they give us money for the others.
For the two cylindrical parallels?
Yes, I can remember distinctly. I was in the lab on that day. I was down in the room downstairs just inside the main door. And he was up with, he went into Joe first, and then I went into Taffy. I never heard what was said in those two meetings, but he came down to me about an hour later and said, I'm out of radio astronomy.
And he went into rain physics.
Right, so I was left with Dover Heights again, and to get to milk the last of the... last of the results out of the 90-foot hole in the ground.
Now, that would be what year, 52 or something like that?
Yeah, about that.
Yeah, but now I'm getting a little confused with the chronology. At that point, the hole in the ground hadn't been built, nor the 17-foot, 18-foot.
The hole in the ground was John's dish.
But had it been built when he left radio astronomy?
It had just about been finished when he left radio astronomy. As I say, even my chronology is hard to fit in. You'll have to fool around with this because so many things were happening to sort of fit the details of him. But I'm just trying to give you the general impression of why these things happened.
Right.
So I'll tell you there's one key you can put in this, putting the timing together. John went to England on a trip, and that'll be somewhere in your archives. And this is where the adapter story comes in. And John was not convinced at that time that Joe was not going to build the interferometer, although I said, I don't think he will. He said, go and look for a site while I'm away. So I was talking to Paul, and Paul said, well, I want to put up the rhombic array somewhere else. And, he said, will you take John Murray and Steve Smird with you and Paul as well? And I got a Blitz ambulance, which was an old Chevy, a truck with a Chevy engine underpowered from the Australian Army. They told me it had been rebuilt, and I was the only one who could drive, particularly a thing with a gearbox like that had on it. And off we went down the south coast looking for sites. It was a terrible year, I remember that. The first night we finished up in Mittagong. The Razorback had been washed out. We got round somehow. They were piling rocks into the road around the base of the mountain. We couldn't even go over the mountain. You know the Razorback?
No, I don't.
It's a road going to Melbourne. It's on the Hume Highway. It's the first, everybody knows the Razorback in Australia, to go over this mountain and then down into Mittagong, which is down in a bit of a valley.
Well, that's near where Dapto is now, isn't it?
No, this is away from Dapto. This was the first night. We barely got there. It's only about 30 or 40 miles from Sydney.
Oh, only that far, I see.
We were finished up in this flea bag of a hotel for the first night, and then we went on through Kangaroo Valley. This is going now towards Dapto.
Right.
And there we were stuck again, which is a real backwoods place. And I remember that night that you could go to the back of Burke and you wouldn't find a hotel like this. And we all thought we'd better have a few drinks before we went to bed, because it turned out that I think there were five of us in the group. It was John Murray, Steve, Paul, myself. John Bolton was in England.
Sheridan, maybe?
No, Sheridan wasn't. Sheridan had nothing to do with it.
Okay.
But anyhow, only one of us could have a bed to ourselves. I remember that. That sort of place. So we thought we might as well get a bit drunk before we got into a bar.
Right.
Well, we didn't like the mob in the bar. It was Saturday night, and everybody had come in and call. So he said, we better go up to the bedroom and finish this off. And he looked up at the back of the bar, and I don't know if you've seen bars in Australia, what they like. There's a line of these fly-blown bottles up the top.
Right.
And there's a couple of bottles of champagne up there, of all things, and a bottle of scotch or something like that. And Paul said, let's have that and that and that. And I heard one of these characters turn to his friend behind me and say, Christ, he said, what's this guy think? He's a bloody Yank.
Buying all this. So you went upstairs and drank it all.
Yeah.
All
right. Now, that was where Dapto was.
So Dapto was the idea that Perhaps these cylindrical paraboloids would go there.
No, we were going to go in Jervis Bay. I picked a site at Jervis Bay.
How do you spell that?
J-R-V-I-S, the Australian Naval Base.
Jarvis?
Jarvis.
Right.
Okay. Jarvis Bay, excuse me.
And
I went on down as far as Bermagui with John Murray. I left Steve. We had another breakdown in the truck, and that's a long story, so I'm going to waste your tape on that. But still, anyhow, we came back. John decided Dapto was a reasonable place for the site, and that was confirmed later for Paul Stuff. Paul had no intention of working where we were.
Oh, I see.
Although there was some rough suggestion that we would.
I see.
And that's how the Dapto site was.
But anyway, Jarvis Bay was never used for any radio astronomy.
No.
I'd never
heard
of that.
But that was the last fling. That was not quite the store that broke the camel's back, but it was close to it.
Right. Okay, so Bolton got out of radio astronomy. You now had this hole in the ground dish, and you were working on the design of the 17 or 18 foot at that time also, or?
No, the hole in the 18 foot had been built.
Well, that came before.
Chronology. It came before, yeah.
Oh,
the hole in the ground was the very last thing.
At Dover Heights.
Right. Okay. John was there when the 18 foot was finished. He was still there, and he knew the spectrum was going on. You need the spectrum work and be done. But then there was this final fling just to try and keep the place alive just a little bit longer. Because I remember Chris saying to me, you know how Chris is, and cynically said one day, well, he said they ought to put a brass plaque on the place now.
You're referring to the hole in the ground when you say the final fling.
Yes.
To keep it alive, yeah.
Yeah.
But now, what work did this dish do beside the deuterium search?
There's a survey by McGee. You'll find there, and I think I'm on that too. Yeah, 400 megahertz survey, right.
Oh yes, 1955.
Right.
Oh yes, that's right, we came across that when we were looking earlier.
Right.
And the deuterium search, those are the main things that it did. What about the hole in the ground? What were its main contributions, would you say?
Very minor, deuterium. Deuterium is the only really important thing that it did, I think.
You left in 55, so that leaves a bit of a gap in there as to what you were doing during that period. Does it not? Or were you working at Dover Heights
right up
until you left?
I was working at Dover. Well, there were several things I was asked to do by Joe. He was... there's one thing I never published, and it concerns, strangely, the United States. Dave Heeshan did his thesis, or what was it? He did his thesis on...
21 centimeter.
Yes, but it's an absorption line in an extragalactic...
Cygnus?
Not in Cygnus, no. Oh, I did the darn thing. I've still got the records at home. Well, he did it, and it was wrong. And Joe was a little suspicious, and he said, I want you to repeat this, Gordon, and do it over. And I did it, and found there was nothing there. Oh, the Omega, I think it was, yeah.
That's not extragalactic.
No, you're right. But there was an absorption line. I can't remember what the importance of the darn thing was now.
It probably something gave the distance of the nebula, probably.
I wasn't very interested. That shows how interested I was. I can't remember. But
I can't quite remember myself.
I found the result was wrong.
But you never published this?
I never published it. I've got the scans and the records at home. I thought I said to Joe when he was I said, well, I said I've had one negative result. I don't want to get into the business of just shooting people down. And I remember saying that to Alan Moffat some years later when he wanted to shoot down something that John Krause had done.
Yeah.
I said the better thing is to write him a letter and tell him.
Yeah.
But Joe had a number of things. He was keen for me, seeing that John was out of it now, he was keen for me to get into something else, and I did that. And that was the last thing I did before. John and I sort of hadn't been in much contact over the period he was in ringmaking. And he just came up to me and said, I need somebody to go as well to the United States. He said, would you like to come? He said, for six months or a year.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't say immediately. I said, well, I'll think about it. And I thought the transition was a little, I could see things were in transition at radiophysics, and I thought, after a little thought anyhow, I thought it would be a better idea.
Were the first discussions concerning a big instrument coming along then, which grew to be the Parkes dish, before you left?